We will offer an alternative to the corruption and the incompetence in the White House. Our government will be progressive, principled, and always on the side of the people. This will take courage, and I know courage is a word that means different things to different people, but for me, courage means doing what is right, even when it is hard. That will be the foundational mission of our administration. We will be California for all.
Governor Gavin Newsom this afternoon after taking the oath of office and making it clear he will continue his predecessor's opposition to President Trump's policies. A policy he wants to enact here in California is to significantly expand paid leave for new parents from the current 6 weeks to 6 months. It would be the most extensive paid parental leave policy in the nation by a long shot. What we don't know is how the governor plans to pay for it. The plan was first reported yesterday by the New York Times, and here to discuss it is Claire Kane Miller, a correspondent for the Times. She covers gender, families, and the future of work. Hi.
Hi.
What are the current rules in California for paid parental leave?
So California was the first state to give it to its citizens and still one of only six states to have enacted it. And new parents get 6 weeks. Birth mothers get another 6 weeks. So they can get a total of 12, which is, you know, very little compared to the rest of the world, but a lot for the United States.
And paid, 12 weeks of paid leave.
That's paid. It's partially paid. It depends on your salary. It's up to about $1,200 a week.
And so this is a lot different from proposals in other states, this proposal by Gavin Newsom.
What he wants to do is expand that to 6 months. There's no state that gives more than 12 weeks right now. So that would be a huge increase.
Right. So one of his aides told you about this plan. Did they say how they would want to pay for it?
So that's the thing. They do not yet know how they want to pay for it. They say they want to work with the legislature on that. California has a very Democratic legislature, but still, paying for things usually means raising taxes. California's current paid leave program is financed by a 1% payroll tax that employees pay. And so the most obvious way to do it would be to increase that a little bit. But for that, to do that significantly, he would need 2/3 votes in the legislature. And it's not entirely clear whether California would be willing to do that.
Well, he has a supermajority of Democrats, so
that's right.
The numbers could be on his side, but he hasn't necessarily made the rounds and gotten them on his side yet.
That's right. And many of the Democrats in California are from, you know, fiscally conservative districts. They still have a lot of constituents who, you know, are worried that the state might be going into a recession, the country might be going into a recession, and they're not entirely comfortable voting for very expensive things. That said, they are very supportive of family-friendly policies like this, and it's just one that the new governor has said he wants to implement. So it could happen.
What are the economic benefits of paid leave? It's not just a drain on the state coffers.
No, not at all. When women take paid leave, when mothers take paid leave, they stay in the labor force. They're more likely to go back to work and they earn more. They're more likely to have careers. And that contributes, of course, to the economy. There's a new study that shows that if paid leave were a national policy, we'd probably have 5 million more prime-age women in the labor force, which is huge for the economy. It also, like I said, means that they earn more. That means they're doing better for their families. Fathers are less likely to leave the labor force after a baby, but when they get paid leave, they're more involved with childcare, which means that the woman can you know, spend more time doing paid work. So it really does have economic benefits.
And so would those economic benefits offset the initial cost to pay for the paid leave?
It's unclear. So California currently has this program for 6 weeks of paid leave for new parents that's been there for a while. So economists have had time to study it. And what they've found is that employers either report that there's not really much of a difference or that it's positive for them in terms of less employee turnover, greater employee morale. It costs a lot when someone, you know, has a baby and then quits and you have to hire someone new. And keep in mind that employers do not actually pay anything for California's current paid leave program. It's all out of employees' paychecks, except, of course, employers do need to find a temporary worker to fill in for the person who is on leave, and that can be a strain, especially for small businesses.
So during the 2016 campaign for president, President Trump did say he supported some version of paid family leave, but nothing really has come out of the White House. Why?
Right. It was very remarkable. It was the first time that Republicans in this country have ever supported paid leave. Both Trump and Marco Rubio supported it on the Republican side. Trump's daughter, Ivanka, has talked a lot about it, yet nothing has come up. Marco Rubio, who, of course, is still in the Senate, has proposed a bill that would give paid leave by allowing new parents to take some of their Social Security early, but it does not have a ton of support at all, particularly because it seems like it would then endanger people's financial security and retirement, and it would be sort of a trade-off that a lot of people don't feel comfortable making parents make.
And how does the United States compare to other nations, other allies, let's say Canada, for example?
So in Canada, parents can have around a year of paid leave. The United States is the only industrialized country in the world that does not provide paid parental leave. Most other countries provide, you know, somewhere around between 4 months and a year and a half.
So it seems like it's up to the states to do that if it's going to happen at this point.
So far, it's only the states. For a long time, there were only three states that had it. Now there are six plus Washington, D.C., and it seems to be expanding.
Well, thank you very much. That's Claire Kane Miller, New York Times correspondent, covering gender, families, and the future of work for The Upshot. Paid parental leave may help parents with newborns, but parents with kids in LA public schools are facing a possible teacher's strike beginning Thursday. And parents like Kevin Napoli, whose child goes to Ivanhoe Elementary in Silver Lake, will have to decide whether to keep their kids home or send them to school.
Most parents in this neighborhood probably both work. So what do you do with your kids? Can't leave them at home alone. There's a cost for everybody, right? There's a cost for the schools. There's a cost for parents trying to figure out what to do with their kids. It's a bit of a mess.
A bit of a mess, an understatement. KCRW's Jenny Hamill has been following the story. She joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, you were out talking to parents this morning, other parents at another school. Tell us about that school and who you spoke with.
So the school I went to is in the Garment District. It's San Pedro Street Elementary, just a stone's throw from Skid Row. About 95% of the kids are Latino. It's a Title I school, which means that all the kids are entitled to a free school lunch. So we've got lower socioeconomic demographics there. So a rainy morning, but all the parents hustling their kids to school either by car or walking them under umbrellas.
And what are they saying about the strike? Are they supporting the teachers?
Some parents didn't know about the strike and learned either through me or through an administrator today. But ultimately, all of the parents that I spoke to, especially the ones that did know about the strike, are all on board with the teachers fighting what they think they deserve. And they say they're fully supportive of the teaching staff. They think they work hard for the kids and deserve more.
And so if they do go on strike, what did the parents say they're going to do with their children?
Yeah, so that was also a mixed bag. I think it is very much contingent on whether you have the support at home or not, or whether you have the resources to pay out for a babysitter or not. So one mother I spoke to, Stephanie Monet, said she will not be sending her kids to school as a show of support to the teachers.
Your kids to school. I will not. I will be supporting our teachers and our staff, and I'll be keeping them at home. I think that our teachers do a lot for our kids, and it's only right for us to support them.
But then I spoke to another mother, Anna Peraza, who learned of the strike and then was told by an administrator after dropping her kid off just today about the resources that will be allocated on the campus if a strike were to occur.
They were only assigned three people to come and help for the whole school, which she said like a window lady, one in the door, and just an aide. I have mixed feelings. Like, I don't know if I do want to bring my daughter or not. I mean, I don't know. It's confusing.
So only three people are assigned to the school for all of the children, and just that, in a supervisory role. They're not teaching them anything.
Yeah, ultimately. I mean, that's a school of, you know, by last count, about 700. This woman said that she will still maybe take her kid to school and see how it works out that first day of the strike, if a strike is to occur, but then kind of gauge from there. But yeah, three people for an entire campus.
What are the kids going to be doing?
I mean, if we look back on previous strikes, the one in 89, you know, you've got hundreds of kids that are kind of shuffled into a gym or an auditorium. And what, I'm not sure, are they watching movies? You know, I did talk to Superintendent Austin Buettner yesterday, and he said there are ways to educate kids that don't rely on a physical body, that, you know, maybe they can use computers or iPads or use technology, is what he said. But I think you can kind of gauge the reality of what an educational experience might look like if there's a handful of staffers there for hundreds of kids.
Right. In high schools, you're talking about kids cutting classes.
Oh, yeah. Well, come on.
No doubt.
Come on.
All right. So the teachers are all going to be walking the picket lines, but there will be some staffers who will have to go to schools, right?
Right. If you're a non-UTLA member or someone who's paid hourly and aren't protected by the unions, like a woman I spoke to this morning, Ruby Vasquez, she is paid hourly. She is a special education aide in the classroom. And so by contract, she says she has to be there, but she also has two kids that attend San Pedro Street Elementary. So she's in an interesting situation.
Our contract says we have to go. So we're going to be supporting the school and the students first and foremost. As a parent, I can tell you that I will be leaving my children at home. Luckily, I have a safe place for them. My parents are there, my siblings, everybody's there to take care of them. But I think it's better to have less bodies at school for us to do better work with the children that do have to be here.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is someone who does acknowledge that they're going to have very limited resources to deal with, you know, the kids that will ultimately have to go to school. So when I talked to Superintendent Buettner yesterday, at last count, they had about 400 subs that were definitely coming in. They've been recruiting parent volunteers. But of course, you do the math. It's easy to see that 30,000 plus leaving these campuses that are supposed to care for about 500,000 kids. You know, they're kind of in a lurch when it comes to staffing during the strike.
Let's talk about the issues that are keeping the two sides apart and what the strike is really all about. What does it come down to?
I mean, there is a deep and wide gulf between what UTLA wants and what the district is offering. The district thus far has offered a 6% pay raise with back pay. They also are offering about $30 million, so that's 1% to 2% of their general fund, to go towards more staffing. So maybe an extra nurse or a librarian on campus. And what they're offering actually totally aligns with what this third-party neutral fact-finding panel that was appointed by the state, the recommendations they came up with. But UTLA says it doesn't even scratch the surface of what they want. UTLA points to this nearly $2 billion reserve that they say the district is hoarding, that they think could be tapped into to make some really substantive changes when it comes to reducing classroom size, when it comes to adding staff, librarians, counselors, nurses. I mean, a lot of these campuses have a nurse that will come to a school of 700 once a week. And they said that just doesn't cut it when you're trying to provide, you know, top rate care for these kids. So they really think there's a lot more money to be spent. They also want reduced standardized testing. They say teachers already inundated with too many kids in class also have to spend a lot of hours out of the day, you know, administering tests or focusing one-on-one with a student on how to better prepare for a specific test. And then they want, you know, their big nemesis in all of this is the charter schools. They want the more regulations for charter schools. They want them to have to pay relocation fees when they do co-locate onto a public school campus. So they've got, you know, a deep set of demands.
And the district is saying, look, we've met your salary demands. We can't spend that $2 billion.
Well, they say it's already spent. They say it's already spent. They say, you know, Buettner told me this yesterday, and this is, you know, it's his word versus Alex Caputo Pearl's word for the last, you know, many weeks. Buettner says, we submitted our budget for the next 3 years to both the county on the state, county and the state. It's $24 billion. That includes that $2 billion reserve. It's already been spent and accounted for. We don't have an extra $2 billion that, you know, we are hoarding away. It's been spent, and we're still marching towards insolvency.
And let's face facts, the state does not spend as much as other states do on public education. California is, what, 46th in the nation?
Yeah, I think it might be 43rd out of all the states in the country.
Half as much as New York City.
Right, exactly. And Buettner did say that 90% of the district's funding comes from the state. So really, you know, the governor-elect, or, you know, presumably the governor as of today, you know, talking about budget allocation, you know, this is something that he's going to have to face as far as education spending in California.
KCRW's Jenny Hamill, thank you so much.
Thanks, Madeline.
And tomorrow I'll be talking with Alex Caputo-Pearl, the head of the teachers union, about the strike and about what he wants. Coming up, our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here to tell us whether President Trump can legally build the wall without congressional approval. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We are now in day 17 of the government shutdown. The sticking point has been, and still is, billions of dollars for President Trump's wall. On Friday, he told reporters he's found a way around the Democrats' intransigence. Trump says he could declare a national emergency along the southern border, and that would allow him to divert money from the military to pay for the wall. And he'd use members of the armed services to build it. Well, that might not be legal. It's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here to break down the legality of that. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal eagle. Welcome.
It's rain on your parade, President Trump Day here at
it
Press
is
Play.
On a lovely rainy day. Well, why would that be illegal?
So there's a couple of problems. One, I think it's not permissible to use the people, to use the military to enforce domestic law. Two, I don't think it's permissible to use the funds to try and divert military funding to build this wall. And three, I think you have a problem using the property. So there is some case law that says by eminent domain, you can take private property, but it doesn't dictate in these situations. It's more about enemies, for instance, taking our property, which Mexico still is not defined as an enemy.
Although he did say that thousands of terrorists were crossing our southern border, which is not true. But he did say that.
He did say that. And so what I think he's trying to do is get at basically an exception to all the rules I talked about. The rules saying you're not allowed to use the military to enforce domestic law. There's an exception that says basically you can detain certain terrorists if they're affiliated with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. So I think he's trying maybe to make that stretch that the refugees who are crossing the wall to try and ask for asylum or other illegal immigrants would be terrorists. But if that entered into a court of law, the problem, as you said, is there's really no evidence to indicate that.
Right, because most of the suspects for international terrorism are arrested at airports.
Exactly, and are not crossing the southern border.
And what is the actual legal statute that says you can't use the military for these purposes?
Yeah, so there's a couple of statutes that were codified actually fairly recently, like in the 1950s and the 1980s, and they basically say, President, you're not allowed to do this. What he's looking at, I think, is the National Emergencies Act, which actually does provide the president with an enormous amount of discretion. So this is one of the things that's interesting about the Trump administration is we didn't used to talk about things like, well, is there anything in the Constitution that says when the president can declare a national emergency, or is it really laid out in any statute? And the answer is no. So the president really has enormous authority, except for some of the limitations we talked about, the limitations which happen to hit exactly what he wants to do here.
He has to really define the national emergency. He has to actually prove it, right?
Well, I think even if he said there is a national emergency, given the facts that we have right now, there still isn't an exception to the law that would say, yes, you get to use the military to build that wall.
What if he says, okay, I'm not going to use the military. I'll use private contractors.
Yeah, I think that that would be seen as just like a little hop, skip, and a jump around circumventing the spirit of the law. But I like where you're going with this, counselors. It would be a very persuasive argument.
Okay, let's go to another shutdown story in the news. The National Park Service says it's going to take the unprecedented step of using money from park entrance fees to bring in some additional staff to clean up the disgusting toilets and campsites.
Right. So another little legal hiccup here, let's say, is that the money for fees is actually designated for visitor services. And so you would think, well, if a law says money for fees used for visitor services, certainly cleaning up trash, patrolling open areas, that sounds like visitor services, but it's actually not. That money is supposed to be used for general operations. So the reason we haven't talked about this in the past I see you pausing.
I'm just thinking about visitor services because that seems like a broad definition.
It does. So this is one of those kind of devil in the detail of how the statute defines words that in the common vernacular maybe mean different things. But visitor services would be like showing a film, would be like making your experience better with respect to hunting, camping, photography. It doesn't include...
Not cleaning toilets?
No, it doesn't include
that.
That
would seem to be number one visitor service.
Yes, those very kind of basic, like take out the trash, clean a toilet, make sure that you're safe, for instance. And what has happened in the past is presidents have said during a shutdown, President George W. Bush said this, President Obama said this, we're not going to keep the national parks open. President Trump said we're keeping them open, maybe in part because the shutdown started over a holiday. But he's not giving any money in order to keep that open. And so the Park Service has said, this is totally untenable. But they don't want to dip into those fees because what they have said is, basically, we don't want to blur that line and then have Congress say to us later when they're trying to budget, well, you have those fees over there. Why don't you at least try and dip into those?
And then they'd have to give them back.
Right.
Or raise fees. And then that's another problem.
Exactly. And we're actually talking about a very small percentage of the money that Congress gives to national parks. We're talking about maybe like $299 million in fees, a budget of about $3.2 billion.
Hmm. Finally, Ruth Bader Ginsburg missed arguments today for the first time in 25 years.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
Well, what I make of that is that she suffered some health issues, that she had surgery dealing with lung cancer, and that she's in her 80s. And I think that for any other person, if she was not the notorious RBG, we would not be saying, oh my God, she missed oral arguments. It really is that she's basically set the bar so high that, I mean, this is kind of a ridiculous example, but I think she set the bar at the place where people think she can be run over by a truck on the way to oral arguments and she'll just tell the ambulance, wait right there, I just need to hear this case and ask a couple questions and then I'll be in there with you. Now, of course, this raises the question of, is President Trump going to get a third appointment to the Supreme Court? And that would obviously, if he was replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg, solidify a conservative majority for the foreseeable future. Happy Monday.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, our complaints about Los Angeles are neither new nor original.
The 16th century was the explorer Cabrillo sailing past the Santa Monica Bay and commenting on the smog.
Los Angeles, as seen through diaries and letters over the centuries, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's hard to put a finger on what makes Los Angeles, L.A., the City of Angels. It is truly a unique city, sprawling yet constantly congested, glamorous and gritty. It's nearly always sunny, but as we know today, it can rain. It's deeply diverse. It bursts with different cultures and languages and viewpoints, and yet it can't quite shake the stereotype that it's superficial, vapid, you know. La La Land. It's complicated, that's for sure. People love it or hate it, or more likely, both. And people have been trying to explain its essence for centuries. Such is illustrated in a new book edited by my next guest, David Kippen. He owns Libros Schmibros, that's a lending library in Boyle Heights. His new book is called Dear Los Angeles, The City in Diaries and Letters, 1542 to 2018. Hi, David.
It's so good to hear you in person again.
Well, it's so good to see you. You describe Los Angeles as a mountain lion we only glimpse in shutter-quick flashes, which is a great visual.
Thank you. Really nice. For my money, selfishly, not enough people notice that at least, you know, 2% of the words in this book are mine, and I'm kind of proud of them. So thank you for noticing. What did you mean by that? I meant that you can't apprehend all of Los Angeles entire. It's too big, it's too complicated, it's too interesting, it's too historic for that. But like those automatic tripwire cameras that they have up in the Santa Monica Mountains, every once in a while you get a glimpse. And if you add up all the glimpses and forget half of them, and by the time you think hard about it, see a bunch of new ones, somehow for a split second, the place can coalesce in your mind. And that's the impression I wanted as much as possible to replicate in Dear Los Angeles.
And you decided to choose a year format. So you start with January, you end up in December.
Yeah, and it serves everybody right who says there's no seasons in Los Angeles. Because you can if you see closely and if you read diaries across the centuries and letters from particular times of the year, you can see, among a million other things, temporal patterns.
Right. But it's also kind of jarring to have someone talking about internment and then the next entry is the Oscars or something. You
know, yeah. And
but jarring in a good way, because it shows the complexity of life, like good and bad happening at the same time.
Have you ever considered a career in book reviewing? I mean, I'm not sure I could do with the competition, but yes, that's exactly what I'm after. You know, to hear about how reluctant Californios in the 19th century were to get off their horses and walk around, and then juxtapose that with how reluctant we are as Angelenos today to give up the steering wheel. It's the same thing. It's
well,
in
right.
the DNA.
So there's so much that is similar from the, what, I don't know, can I say the 16th century to now in terms of the complaints?
Absolutely. The 16th century was the explorer Cabrillo sailing past the Santa Monica Bay and commenting on the smog.
Really?
I mean, there was no Spanish word for smog at the time, but it was and still is in, I'm going to get the language wrong, but in the Native American tongue spoken at the time, the Bay of Smokes.
Fascinating.
Yeah, on a good day.
Well, so I just want to go through some examples of that. So there is, and I had to write this down because I didn't memorize this, but you have in 1949, Aldous Huxley saying, "In this fourth year of drought, everything is horribly parched. The stream is dry, the oaks losing their leaves, even the pine trees unhappy. A few more seasons of this kind of thing in the whole of Southern California will have gone back to the coyotes."
Glad we put all that behind us.
And he writes,
you?
Which might be a good thing, perhaps.
Yes.
Which is the key coda.
Sorry to interrupt you before the money line. Yes, absolutely. Huxley was one of a jillion outsiders, interlopers, who come here, in his case, and illustriously, and Christopher Isherwood's and other, Eric Knight, a wonderful screenwriter I could talk to you for half an hour, who come here and either hate it or go native. Huxley was here, moved up after he, you know, tried hallucinogens in the Santa Monica Mountains and had his mind blown listening to Bach, moved up to Little Rock and the Santa Clarita area and lived out in the desert and, yes, experienced the same drought that basically drove the socialists who started a commune there 50 years before away.
So people complaining about the smog, in another language, complaining about the drought, also traffic. And also not being able to afford to live here. Raymond Chandler in 1956 said, "I just can't afford to live here. There's nothing for me to write about."
But Christopher Isherwood in 1939 saying, "Well, we had an hour to kill, so we spent it finding an apartment." I haven't memorized much of the book, but I sure memorized that one.
So what was, aside from the year conceit in terms of organizing, how did you choose who to put in and which quotes of theirs to use?
Well, I mean, we're cracking up here because humor is obviously part of it. And so is heartbreak and atrocity. And I wanted those things side by side. And juxtaposition was part of it. I mean, you know, there were irresistible diary and letters that I had to put in no matter what was up against them. But the idea of putting them side by side and hearing the squeak they made when you rubbed them up against each other, that was part of it, too. There were people I wanted to represent. I mean, I would say to myself, huh, if there's no Octavia Butler in here, there damn well better be. And sure enough, the Huntington Library has the trove. Mm-hmm. So I wish I'd spent a lot more time with that than I did. But I found gold enough, you know, her discovering the Twilight Zone and realizing she wasn't the only weird person on the planet. I mean, to read that diary entry is mind blowing. And you know, it was such fun, so addictive that I don't want to walk away from it. I mean, this book is done. It's in hardcovers. I'm incredibly pleased and proud and incredulous about that. But I would love it to have a life and maybe even make way somehow or make room for diaries and letters from other eras or this one or eras to come.
You did include a line from James Joyce. And you did admit in the back where you describe all the contributors as James Joyce having never been to Los Angeles.
Not that we know of.
So this line, which I love, is from Finnegan's Wake, 1939. And it's very simple. It says, "Let me be Los Angeles."
And he is.
But no comma. So not "let me be, comma, Los
I never
Angeles.
Thought of that. You know, you can't trust Joyce with punctuation either.
Right.
So maybe the ambiguity was intentional, Ms. Daughter of an English Professor.
So do you think he wanted to be Los Angeles or did he wanted Los Angeles to let him be?
I leave that for the Joyceans to decide, but I think both are valid readings. Can you tell that I'm not only a book critic but an academic now in my
yes,
cockeyed way?
Yes, you're hedging.
Yeah. Hey, if you don't hedge, you know, then you know nobody can vote against you for tenure, right?
But what it does illustrate is exactly what you're talking about, the sort of ambiguity and the feeling of love-hate that we have about our city.
Absolutely. You don't have to ever set foot in the place to love it and or hate it, though if you love it, I guess the odds are better that you might actually visit and be either disappointed or never want to leave again. I mean, I share some of that ambiguity. I'm from here. And in fact, the title of the book, Dear Los Angeles, yes, it sounds like a love letter. And LA Magazine, where I write book reviews, ran a bunch of excerpts and headlined it, "I Love You, Los Angeles." And that's true. But it's not all there is to it. I mean, there are disgraceful things that happened here. Los Angeles has a lot of blood on its hands and still does. But it's home.
You grew up here and you have spent a long time writing about thinking about Los Angeles. What did you learn doing this book that you hadn't known about your city?
I learned that Theodore Dreiser was a horn dog. The author of Sister Carrie was a sex maniac.
Really?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I did not anticipate that Dear Los Angeles would be a dirty book. I encourage parents within the sound of my voice to rip out the appropriate
page
pages.
That on so I can...
Dreiser's in the index. Are you old enough for this, Matt?
How was he writing letters to someone describing
No. He was describing day by day in his diary his exploits in between, you know, going out to the Santa Monica Pier and riding the Dodgem cars and going over the Colorado Street Bridge to the Castle Green, where I live right now, and partaking of a restaurant that is long, long, long gone, and confiding to his diary his adventures.
You have celebrities in here as well. Marilyn Monroe.
Marilyn Monroe is in here writing very fondly to her stepson about the experience of sharing her first dance, and I gather not her last one, with RFK, whose much less happy experience in Southern California in 1968 is also recounted by Alistair Cook, the great British broadcaster and an inspiration to us all here on radio, who was there at the Ambassador Hotel when he was shot.
Right. And you have also an entry from Sirhan Sirhan.
Absolutely, I do, who was a Pasadena City College undergrad who confided to a notebook not long before RFK must die.
Mm. And as I said earlier, you repeated, which is nice because you see the trajectory of it, diary entries of a young woman, a young girl, who was interned, a Japanese American. So it starts off fairly innocently, and then we find out later that she's been interned.
Yeah, I mean, that was a harrowing diary that I found thanks to the Japan American National Museum downtown in Little Tokyo. And without that, I think the book would be so much poorer. And yeah, like a lot of other things in the book, they're not pretty and you're maybe tempted to avert your eyes. But I wanted this book to be as complete and all-embracing and honest and, yes, occasionally sensationalistic. I mean, it's up to the minute, not just with my students' diary entries, but with tweets from Ryan Reynolds and Brandon McCarthy, whom I still desperately miss at the LA Dodgers because he was the funniest guy on the team, even if he couldn't always pitch very well.
Ryan Reynolds.
Yes.
Well, what was that entry?
Oh, I hope I can do it justice from memory unless you, being the magnificent broadcaster that you are, have it in front of you.
People in L.A. are deathly afraid of gluten. I swear to God, you could rob a liquor store in this city with a bagel.
Is that great? I mean, if he has a ghostwriter for his tweets, I don't want to know about it. And I want to hear from him denying it because that, I mean, I'm a book critic. I like to think I know a thing or two about comedy. And that line is just streamlined and aerodynamic, and I wouldn't change a syllable.
Well, he's Canadian, so he's supposed to be nice.
But they know a thing or two about getting a laugh.
Well, I guess I'm wondering also about your method, because you were combing Twitter, you were combing archives, you were combing volumes of letters and diaries. How did you do your research?
I was a total magpie. I mean, I followed my nose. I teach at UCLA, so I spent time in special collections. I spent a fair amount of time at the Huntington Library, and God knows they have the keys to the kingdom. And there's published stuff that's long since out of print that I wasn't going to leave lying on the table. But it's a very idiosyncratic book. I mean, for a book that has basically the acknowledgments, the preface, the dedication, and not much else of my own verbiage, which, as you may know, I'm not usually shy about sharing, I think of it as a kind of autobiography. I picked these entries, and they, I hope, get across something of what makes me love and blush about Los Angeles. But anybody who makes it to the end, whether in one gulp, which I wouldn't advise, or day by day in a small white room, or however anybody wants to read this book, I think they probably come away from it, heaven help them, with a fair idea of who I am, too.
Interesting. So very personal.
Yes. I mean, that book, I've spent 7 years rooming with Los Angeles. And inevitably, yeah, some of me rubbed off. But there was a lot of Los Angeles to rub off on.
Let me be Los Angeles.
You may.
Thank you.
You and James Joyce both.
The book is called Dear Los Angeles, The City in Diaries and Letters, 1542 to 2018. Edited by David Kippen. Thank you so much.
I so enjoyed it.
Coming up, the Golden Globes highlighted the very slow progress of women in Hollywood, and a new study shows only 4 of the top 100 movies made last year were directed by a woman. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
In the next 2 years, everything that I produce, I am making a vow, and it's going to be tough, to make sure that everything that I produce that is 50% women.
Regina King pledged Time's Up, Time's Two in her acceptance speech at the Golden Globes last night. She won Best Supporting Actress for her role in If Beale Street Could Talk. Despite time being up, not a single woman was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Director this year. And women were shut out of the category last year. In fact, very few women directors have ever been nominated, and only one has ever won. Barbara Streisand, and that was 35 years ago. A new study from USC Annenberg found that out of the top 100 films of last year, only 4 were directed by a woman. Stacey Smith is the founder and director of USC Annenberg's Inclusion Initiative. I spoke with her about her study before last night's Globes. So, Stacey, you looked at the top 100 films every year for the last 12 years. Just a quick definition. What does it mean, a top film?
A top fictional film that we studied usually makes somewhere around 20 million or more at the box office. And these are usually what we like to consider the agenda-setting films that are distributed both domestically here in the U.S. as well as many of them go international.
And as I mentioned, just four women directed the top 100 films last year.
Right. And what we have found across the top 1,200 films is usually is a right around 4% of all directors are women. But what's really interesting is the intersectional nature of our data. Out of 1,335 directors, only 9 are women of color. It's actually only 7 women. 2 of them have worked twice. So we're seeing very few women from a variety of different racial and ethnic backgrounds. Very few of them get to participate in the filmmaking process at this level.
And the 1,200 is over 12 years.
Exactly.
And over that time span, over that dozen years, have you seen any change at all in terms of percentages?
No, what we typically see is a flat line. And so this is a very interesting report for us because this is the first time across the 12 years evaluated that we're able to actually say that we have seen a change. The number of Black directors has doubled from 2007 to 2018, and it's almost tripled since last year. And so it's a historic finding that we hope will continue on next year and the years to follow.
But most of those directors are men.
Exactly. We're still seeing impediments for female directors being attached at the highest level with these films. And so while gains are being made in one venue for filmmakers, there's still a lot of work and a lot of progress that needs to be made around female filmmakers.
And what about for Asian or Latino filmmakers, male or female?
We're seeing, at least over the last 12 years, there has been no change in terms of Asian filmmakers. Now, one thing that's unique about this report that we put out this year that will inform our future studies is that over the last 3 years, we took a deep dive and we looked at not only underrepresented directors, but also producers and below-the-line talent. And across the last 3 years, if you look at all underrepresented racial ethnic groups, there's actually a notable uptick from 2016 to 2018. So next year, we will break out the findings across different racial and ethnic groups to be able to address exactly how different individuals from different racial and ethnic identities are doing behind the camera.
Another interesting statistic you included in your report was how long men work versus women, the longevity of their careers. And you found that men work pretty much nonstop, maybe until they drop dead, but not the same for women.
Absolutely. And I think there are two pieces of information from the report that really get at this idea of a fiscal cliff facing women. First, women work across 4 decades of their careers, whereas men work across 7. And if you look to our pipeline data, it starts to reveal why. As women move from independent filmmaking to television to top feature content, we see the numbers drop over time. And so in the independent space, about 28% of all directors are women. In television, it could be around 20 to 25%, whether it's first-time directing or directing episodic shows across different platforms. But in features, it's only 4% of directors are women. And so as opportunities increase across these platforms for males, they decrease for females.
Why do you think that is? There's been such a public outcry, the Time's Up movement. The movie industry has been called out repeatedly for not hiring more women, and there have been efforts made. Why hasn't it panned out?
Well, I think there's a few things that we can look to in this data and some of the other work that we've done. There are a few women in the executive ranks, whether it's at the board of directors level or at the executive film team level across these companies. And most producers are white males. And so producers are really important. They are often the individuals that bring the stories and hire directors onto open directing assignments. And what's really important about this research is we show just how problematic those numbers are for female producers, particularly women of color. Only 2%, that's with rounding, of producers are women of color. So we're seeing an epidemic of invisibility in the executive ranks and in the producerial ranks where these leaders are making decisions about who to attach to feature films.
This is the beginning of award season. Is it helpful when you have actresses on stage and on television and televised awards ceremonies calling out Hollywood and saying you need to do better?
Absolutely. And I think what this does is it lets those folks in the audience know. And those messages are far reaching, not only in this country, but people are tuning in from around the world to really understand that women care about this issue and they want to see change. One of the things that's really important that the press has been talking about, saying the numbers haven't moved since Time's Up. Well, the gestation for a film is often much longer than 12 months. And I think we're seeing the beginning of change here in this data. And what we need to see from the public is continued pressure on these companies, encouraging them when they take steps in the right direction, and making sure that female directors and directors from a variety of different backgrounds, whether it's racial and ethnic diversity, people with disabilities, directors from the LGBTQ community, making sure that their hiring decisions reflect the world that we actually live in, not the world in their limited imagination.
Stacey Smith is the founder and director of USC Annenberg's Inclusion Initiative. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Madeline.
And joining us now is Christian Bordahl. Hello.
Hey there, Madeline. Well, there may be a teacher's strike here in LA, as you know, as soon as Thursday. You talked earlier with KCRW reporter Jenny Hamill about that. So I asked listeners who have kids in public school if there is a strike, whether they plan to send their kids to school or not. Tor Leonard says most LAUSD parents, like myself, can't afford to send their kids somewhere else during the strike, so they'll be attending school. Cynthia Waldman says, my kid will be at home studying and working independently to learn the material for his 4 AP classes. The AP exams don't care about the strike, and he won't be learning in an auditorium with 200 other kids. Hadn't thought about that. Chris Cookson says, if there's a protest, take them to it. Make a sign together. Get pizza ready at the demonstration. One of the best lessons you can teach a kid is how to fight back. And I'm a juror who describes herself as wife and mother to my sweet leeches on Twitter. She agrees. She says, my kids will join their teachers on the picket line with their homemade signs. So I did run a little Twitter poll on this as well to get some rough numbers. And 23% of the people who responded said, yes, my kids are going to be going to school. Another 11% said, I'm looking for an alternative, trying to figure out what to do with my kids if there's a strike. 66% said, no, my kids will not be going to school if there's a strike. So I guess they'll be hanging out at home if they're high school age or whatever. By the way, Alex Caputo-Pearl, who's head of the teachers union, will be on the show with you tomorrow.
Yep.
So if listeners have any questions for him, they can go to kcrw.com/curious and post those questions, and we will try to ask them. Or they can just tweet them straight to us at KCRW.
And one of the things I'm interested in is whether he thinks this is a good policy in terms of getting parents on his side.
It's been a long time since there's been a teacher strike, and it was a big disruption at the time.
Yeah, and whether he expects parents to be on his side or not.
Mm-hmm.
Given that parents have just come off a 3-week vacation.
Yes, and maybe they're ready to kick the kids out and
exactly.
Send them back to school again.
All right, thank you, Christian Bordahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.